Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, and welcome to New Books in Genocide Studies, part of the New Books Network of podcasts. My name is Kelly McFall from Newman University, and I'm a host on the show. This episode is a little bit different than the usual. Ordinarily, we feature a single book and talk about it with the author. Today, we're actually going to talk about a journal. Holocaust and Genocide Studies is one of the preeminent academic journals on the topic, and its first issue was published just short of 25 years ago. For many of those years, Richard Brightman has edited the journal, and I thought it would be appropriate to reflect on the history of the journal and on the field with someone who's been one of its most important figures. Richard is distinguished professor emeritus of history from American University, and he's edited the journal, as I said, for 15 years or so. So, Richard, thanks for joining us, and welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Kelly.
So, Richard, before we talk about the journal, maybe you can say a few words about how you became a historian and how you became interested in the Holocaust.
Those are two separate issues. I was always very interested in history growing up, and in college, history courses were my favorite courses, but I wasn't quite sure about what to do. I was offered a chance for a one-year teaching fellowship after I graduated to see if I liked graduate school and teaching, and that convinced me that I should give it a try. So it worked out. I went to graduate school at Harvard, and I finally got a job. It wasn't an easy matter then, and it isn't easy now, I've stayed a historian.
And why focus on the Holocaust? Where did that interest come from?
My first book was not in the area of the Holocaust. It was, however, in German history in the Weimar period, so it wasn't all that far from it. And when I was looking for a topic for a second book, somebody asked me to work on a project, maybe a conference or an exhibition dealing with America and the Holocaust. And that was kind of the beginning of it. It took a while. It really partly emerged when I got involved in looking at all the sources at the National Archives in Washington, because there were just almost unlimited sources, not just in U.S. history, but in German history. And the coverage of the Nazi period was particularly intense. And my department chair at AU, when I got a job there, had asked me to teach a course on Nazi Germany. Mm-hmm. So things came together.
That's an interesting path. And I wonder, I know a number of graduate students listen to the show. What do you think, that's a typical path? Do people come to this field or a field because there's a set of documents that available to them, or do they come to an interest and then go pursuing the documents? I mean, what's been your experience as you've directed graduate students and worked in the field?
Well, I think the field has changed a great deal over time. Mm-hmm. When I was in graduate school, there were very few courses in the Holocaust. You didn't really train to become a specialist in the Holocaust because there weren't very many people who had established themselves and were training graduate students. Raoul Hilberg was at University of Vermont, but he was a political scientist, and not too many historians trained with him. Mm-hmm. So you really had to kind of feel your way. I think a lot of people who became Holocaust experts were trained by Gerhard Weinberg at the University of North Carolina, but he wasn't writing about the Holocaust itself. Mm-hmm. He was writing about Nazi Germany and related diplomatic subjects. So to some extent, people became self-trained as Holocaust experts as they themselves became interested, or as the subject became, what shall I say, of more general interest to American society and to the West generally. These days, there are plenty of Holocaust specialists who are, you know, hundreds of people, including yourself, I imagine, are teaching the Holocaust. And, you know, it's not all that hard to get trained as a Holocaust specialist, but getting a job is still difficult.
So let's talk about the journal. How and why was Holocaust and Genocide Studies founded?
Yehuda Bauer at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem decided that the field really needed a journal. And he was able, through connections, and I don't know all the details, I should say, but he was able to set up a journal published by Pergamon Press, which was part of Robert Maxwell's publishing empire. Mm-hmm. I don't know how many people in the audience recognize the name of Robert Maxwell, but once upon a time, he was well known as a big businessman in the UK, and his financial empire ultimately collapsed. And Pergamon Press was part of it. So the journal needed a new home. The United States Holocaust Memorial Museum had participated with the Hebrew University of Jerusalem in supporting the journal initially. And it was around 1994 when Yehuda made a decision, and the museum made a decision, that it was perhaps a good time to shift the base of the journal to the United States and to the museum. So that's when I was invited to become co-editor with Bauer for a limited period of time, and eventually to move up to the position of editor, and that happened in 1996.
I went back and I looked at the table of contents for the first couple of years of the journal, and I was impressed by a couple of things. And one of those is the number of contributors from across the globe. I wonder how was the journal able to establish that kind of international presence so quickly?
Well, to some extent, it was international from the beginning because of the Israeli-American connection. Maybe I should talk about what I know best, which is my own strategy. I was quite busy when I moved up to the position of editor, and I was half berating myself for having taken on another important responsibility. And I said, how am I going to do this? I can't really predict, you know, where the cutting edge of this field is, let alone where it's going to go, you know, in the next 5 years or the next 10 years. And I'm not as well networked as some people, and I'm not going to be in a position to call up Professor X and beg for a manuscript on such and such a topic. And eventually I came to the conclusion that I should make a virtue out of necessity and simply make it known through whatever channels were available that we were going to publish good scholarship on whatever area of the Holocaust or genocide people were writing about. You didn't have to be in with the editor or an associate editor. You didn't have to be part of the currently trendy area of the field. We were going to take the best of what came in, submit it to peer review, edit it carefully, and do the best we could with it for academic readers, but also for a general educated audience. And because the museum was fortunately willing to support the journal, not only in terms of publication costs, but basically hiring one or more assistant editors to help out with the editing, that gave us the chance to infuse more quality and value to the readers than some other journals that were financially limited. So we put out the word, and for the first couple of years, we struggled to get enough good manuscripts, but we kept the word out there, and we kept getting more and more, and it's spread. We now get manuscripts from all over the world. We don't, what shall I say, slot geographical areas or particular themes. People sometimes ask, you know, why don't you have more on genocide in Asia? Why don't you have more on non-Holocaust topics? I say, submit the manuscript and we'll evaluate it. And if it gets through, we'll publish it. So it's really a question of judging what is a good quality manuscript and then editing it well enough so that a broad audience can read it.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that, because one of the things Yehuda Bauer talked about in his introduction to the journal was, in fact, the way in which his imagination for the journal was distinctive because it combined Holocaust and genocide studies together. So you've kind of touched on this already, but how do you see that those two is that one field? Are those two fields? Are those, how do those fit together in terms of your understanding and imagination? And do you have to think through that connection as you select articles, or maybe you already said that you just take the best of whatever is sent?
Generally speaking, we take the best of what comes in. We don't require people who write on, what shall we say, other genocides, genocides other than the Holocaust. We don't require them to make a connection with the Holocaust, nor do we require people who do sort of straight Holocaust topics to make broader comparisons. But often they emerge. Mm-hmm. So when we get comparative topics, comparative manuscripts, we're particularly happy and we try to do well by them. But we do have a general tendency to see things either in the area of the Holocaust or in the area of other genocides. The journal historically has had a good number of high quality manuscripts on the Armenian genocide. Mm-hmm. And we've published a good deal there. We've had a smaller number of quality manuscripts on more recent genocides, but we are always happy when something in that area makes it through peer review and mm-hmm. Gets published. So we sometimes get criticized because we do more in the area of the Holocaust than more recent genocides, but it's largely a function of what comes in and secondarily what gets through peer review.
A similar kind of question. You haven't talked much about discipline. Do you think of the journal as interdisciplinary or historical, or do you prefer a mix? What's the editorial vision for that?
It is historically an interdisciplinary journal. Mm-hmm. We used to say so in our mission statement. I would say the majority of articles published are either by historians or by political scientists who are pretty close to history. But in the early years, there were a good number of people when Yehuda Bauer was editor who were in philosophy or religion. We still have some articles. One of our most downloaded articles is by somebody in philosophy. We get a fair number of articles in literature. I would say sociology is not as common, religion not as common these days, but we like to see interdisciplinary pieces, both within particular articles, people who can make use of different disciplines, but also in a given issue of the journal. If we have, you know, three articles by historians, it's good if, you know, one or two are by people outside of history.
So you use the term peer review, and some of our audience will know exactly what that means and perhaps be peer reviewers. But probably a good percentage of our audience doesn't have a good feel for what the process is for selecting articles that go into a journal. So can you say a little bit about how an article moves from submission to actually appearing in the journal?
Happy to. We get usually entirely unsolicited manuscripts submitted to us. Occasionally somebody will inquire first, I've got a manuscript on such and such a topic. Would you like to see it? And we say, virtually always say yes, unless it's, as far as we can tell, irrelevant to either the Holocaust or genocide. So it comes in, and I like to read everything. Things have gotten to the point where once in a rare while, I'll rely on my two associate editors to do the initial screening, but I read virtually everything. And then the manuscript goes to one of the associate editors, Gabi Finder, whom you know, mm-hmm. and Zvi Gittleman, whom you may know. If either reader in-house thinks it has a chance of being published, we then look for experts on the particular topic of the manuscript. And we all know people who are academics, and you know, sooner or later we find experts, and the experts give us a confidential opinion, which is suitable for sending to the author, at least in paraphrased form. Sometimes we send when readers are diplomatic, we send the actual evaluation. When they're perhaps a little bit tactless, we will paraphrase some things, but we basically send the reading to the author, and in a blind way. The identity of the readers are not disclosed to the author. The identity of the author is not disclosed to the readers. So it's double blind, if you like. Mm-hmm. And it takes, for a normal article, it takes two recommendations to publish before we're willing to publish. We have something called a research note, a kind of specialized and usually shorter article, and we only require one recommendation to publish for a research note. Occasionally, the two readers will disagree, and then we have to go to a third reader, and we usually give the author a chance to revise before going to a third reader. So, you know, I'd like to say that peer review is a perfect process. It isn't. It's merely the best thing that the academic world has come up with. Once in a while, we published some things that reviewers liked better than I did, but we went ahead and published it. The main intervention of the editor and the associate editors is initially where we screen things, some things out entirely, and in other cases, we make some suggestions to the author. You really ought to revise this in such and such a way before we send this out for peer review. But ultimately, the peer review is what decides things most of the time.
So how long does it take for a an ordinary article to move from the point where it crosses onto your desk or into your email folder to actually appearing in the journal?
Well, that depends both on peer reviewers, but also on our backlog. The peer reviewers, we try to ask them for a decision and a written piece of advice that can be sent to the author within a couple of months, but sometimes it takes longer. If it goes to a third reader, it's going to take longer still. Our backlog at present is about a year and a half. So even if something gets through tomorrow, it's not going to appear immediately. And we like to maintain a sort of uniform standard of keeping things in line. But occasionally something will be on a topic that is so current and urgent that we will move things up or back in the interests of the journal and the particular author's need to get something out right away.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So if you're talking to a graduate student, and what would you say in terms of how best to, what can that person do to submit an article that is likely to be approved, or at least be competitive to approve? What does a graduate student need to think about as they create an article?
Okay, well, I taught graduate students for many, many years, so I will repeat the advice that I gave to them, probably too often. First of all, you have to be interested in the topic, because it's a lot of hard work, and you don't have the interest to sustain you. It's not going to show in the quality of the work. Secondly, you need to catch the reader's attention right away. So the first paragraph really has to be enthusiastic or attention grabbing in some respect. Sometimes it's through telling a particular story, but more often it's, well, here is an urgent problem in the field, in the world today. Somehow catch the reader's attention. Then you need to explain your approach. What piece of this problem will you address in this particular manuscript? Then you need to, anywhere from a page to a few pages, you need to explain that, well, actually, you're not the first one in the world to have addressed this topic and this subject before. So you need to summarize other relevant pieces of the literature. Sometimes you're agreeing with what has been done before, but you're adding something to it. Sometimes you're disagreeing with what has been done before. Sometimes you're looking at a known source, but reading it in a different way. Sometimes you've discovered an entirely new source, which causes you to come to different conclusions than, or to extend a topic that has been covered before. And you kind of want the reader to be able to have the context by the time you go into a presentation of your story, of your evidence, of your argument. And you need an argument. This is probably more true in some fields than others, but if you're simply narrating, the odds are the peer reviewers will say at the end, why is all of this important? So it helps to have a clear argument, but you may or may not present your argument up front. Sometimes it works better to present an argument in its fullest form at the end of the manuscript, after you prepared the way step by step through a close reading of your evidence. So that's kind of the basic structure. It's not the only structure that works for a journal article, and we've certainly published good articles that didn't have that structure, but That's a kind of template that a graduate student can use and play off of in trying to figure out what's going to get through.
Well, that's good advice. Let's switch gears a little bit. Holocaust and Genocide Studies is one of the preeminent journals in the field, but it's not the only one. How do you see your journal fitting into this broader ecosystem of journals and of book series about the topic? Do you see yourself as a competitor, collaborator, just working separately? Do you even think about other journals as you do your work? How does that fit?
We got started so early, 1986, partly through longevity, we've established ourselves. I do look at other journals occasionally, but I can't say that I read them, Holocaust and Genocide Studies journals, that I read them all the time. Gabi Finder reads a good number of them. I guess the fairest thing to say is that we work separately. When we get something that isn't quite good enough for us or isn't quite right for us because of the way the peer reviewers reacted to, you know, the subject, we mention other related journals as possibilities. And when somebody's complained that we've made a mistake, we often come back and say, yes, we may have made a mistake and our peer reviewers may have made a mistake, but if we did, the odds are you're going to find another good journal in the field. And so you have our good luck.
So you're in kind of a unique position as having been editor for this long of time and seeing the work that's being done. How have you noticed the field changing in the years you've edited the journal, and whether that's in the kind of articles you get or the kind of people who are sending them? How have things changed in your years?
Okay, I could probably tackle that from several different angles. You've already noted one. It's become a journal that gets some attention worldwide. We get readers in Asia and Africa. We get submissions in Asia and Africa. We get submissions from Latin America. We have a worldwide reach. I would say that the U.S., Europe, and Israel are still the regions that have the greatest involvement, but it's a question of what gets through peer review. In terms of areas of coverage, well, we do get more coverage of other non-Holocaust genocides. We get within the Holocaust more coverage of Eastern Europe than we used to. This is partly a matter of archival sources becoming available, but it's also the way in which the field has shifted. I am not sure I could draw clear conclusions about the balance of disciplines beyond what I said earlier, which is that once upon a time, philosophy and religion were very important, and they've become important, but not quite as numerous the manuscripts as in the early years of the journal. Within history, gender has become more important. We get a good number of submissions on gender. Some get through, some don't. Being popular is one thing, but it still has to get through peer review. So that's a kind of rough sense of where things have gone. The heart of the journal is still the Holocaust. We get, you know, the majority of submissions dealing with the Holocaust in Germany itself and in German-controlled areas, but we get, you know, manuscripts on the United States during the Holocaust or other countries during the Holocaust quite frequently.
Journals have existed for centuries in something like the same form, certainly for decades. In a world which has changed technologically and economically, how are these changes that we're living through, how are they going to shape the future of academic journals? Do you see academic journals persisting in more or less the same form, or will they change? What do you think of the future?
I'm old enough that I'm probably not the best one to predict the future, especially because it depends on technology. And I can tell you one thing. We used to fixate on the number of individual subscribers to the journal. And that number has gone down and down, not just with us, but with academic journals generally, to the point where libraries, you know, wonder, do they have to subscribe to journals? Yes, they do. More and more people either download entire issues of the journal or download individual articles. And, you know, this really has changed the quote-unquote market for academic journals. You know, we used to talk about hundreds of journal subscribers. Now we're talking about, at least in one recent year, more than 100,000 downloads of journal articles. So I think some things are gained and some things are lost. I think readers do not get the same level of comprehension and involvement when they read something on screen as they do when they read a physical issue of the journal or a book. But in terms of convenience, in terms of quick exposure and use in a research paper or in a dissertation, the convenience of digital access is wonderful. And so we're just going to have to come to grips with this. And I don't know what technology will be available in 20 years for journals, but it will probably be better than what there is today.
So you mentioned in 20 years, and I won't phrase it quite that way, but you have a sense of perspective. Where would you like to see Holocaust studies or Holocaust and genocide studies as a field or a journal, whichever you'd like to talk about, or both? Where would you like to see them go in the next decade?
I'd like more people to recognize how important this topic is. Genocide is about as terrible a human experience as one can imagine. And we as human beings need to learn from the past. If we can't learn from the worst of all human experiences, how are we going to make ourselves as individuals and as societies better as history moves forward? So I would like to get that sense across. And to some extent, this is a plea for history generally as relevant to each of us and to our societies every day and in almost every way. I used to make a case for the importance of history, and I now have a very current example that backs that up. This is not, unfortunately, related to genocide, but I will tell the story anyway. Mm-hmm. There was a guy in New Zealand who launched a campaign and kept it up year after year to commemorate the victims of the 1918 so-called Spanish flu. Eventually, he got the ear of a leading politician in New Zealand who became a prime minister. And that memorial was built and completed in 2019. Mm-hmm. And that prime minister was well aware of the danger of a pandemic when COVID-19 hit. And New Zealand today has no active cases of coronavirus. They had a very strict lockdown. The last time I looked at their death totals, 21 people in New Zealand had died from coronavirus. So, yes, one can learn things from history. And some of them are even practical.
So we've taken a lot of your time. Is there anything else about the journal that you'd like to say that I haven't thought to ask about?
We encourage people at all levels to submit to the journal. We occasionally get some things from undergraduates or master's students. They don't usually have enough grasp of the field overall to get through peer review, but we'll look at them. Mm-hmm. Read the journal first to get an idea of what kinds of things we publish. And if you think you've got something that's important, please send it to us. And you can go to Oxford University Press's website or to the museum website and get further details about where to send and how to send to the journal. Please send us your thoughts.
So that's for the journal. What about you? What are you doing? You're emeritus. Are you continuing to write, or is editing your main academic activity nowadays? What's up for you next?
Well, I'm sort of between books. I came out with a book called The Berlin Mission in October 2019. I had promised to write for a collection, an article on the Allies and the Holocaust, and I'm working on that article right now, and I'm still debating what topic I will turn to next for my next book project.
I've said this on the show a few times that I've only had one person when I've asked that question. I've only had one person who I think, if I recall right, his answer was, "I'm going to go garden because writing a book is a very hard thing to do and I deserve a break." And academics don't seem to take breaks. But I know you and I have chatted about maybe doing an interview with Berlin Mission, and I'm hoping that we can arrange that and you'll be back on the show. But until then, thanks so much. For talking to us about the journal, as you said, it's a wonderful journal, and I've been a subscriber for decades now, which I guess says something about my age. But I highly recommend it, and as Richard said, go to the Holocaust Memorial Museum website or to the Oxford Press website, and you can subscribe there and support the work that Richard and all of his colleagues are doing. So, Richard, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it. And until next time, have a wonderful summer.
Thank you, Kelly. Thanks. It was fun talking with you.